Nigel Clark and Michael Chanyu-Wills. You're both very welcome. How are you?
Very well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, fine, thank you.
Excellent. Right now, so I know you've been working on movies of all different kinds and also some television for a number of years. I think one of your first works was it Little Vampire, wasn't it? I know you generated a bit of attention back in 2001. So that's 10 years ago now. Has time flown for you both?
It was, yeah, a bit before that, actually. 1997, when Nigel and I met up in Notting Hill, wasn't it? We were chatting and we thought it might be fun to collaborate on something. This is back when I was a student at the Academy and Nigel was teaching there, and I was doing composition classes with him. A few years, or at least about a year or two after that, we met up for a coffee in Notting Hill, and within, I don't know, about 6 weeks or 2 months of that meeting, by some extraordinary chance, Nigel got a phone call, didn't you?
Mm. It was really bizarre because though we thought it might be a fun, nice idea to do something in the area of film, we didn't really know that much about it, and we didn't really know how to go about it. And it was just one of those very happy accidents when we got a phone call from a colleague and a friend of ours. In fact, he was the principal of the Royal Academy of Music, Sir David Lumsden, saying a friend of his was making a film and they didn't have any composers and would we like to go along and meet the producer.
Oh, yeah.
So it was a, you know, really that sort of bolt of lightning luck that doesn't happen that often. So it was fantastic.
I was always told at the Academy that getting your first film was a bit like winning the lottery. and getting your second film was like winning the lottery again. That was an extraordinary chance event, really. And that was a film called Jinnah.
Christopher Lee.
Starring Christopher Lee as Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who founded Pakistan in 1947.
Oh, I see. Right, so lots of ethnic music.
Quite a bit, yeah. Absolutely. We have quite a few stories about Sufi singers on that one.
Yeah, it was a sort of baptism of fire because, you know, we had to work out how to sync music to film, which we had an idea from reading textbooks but not really knowing how to do it. And I remember particularly Michael spending hours sort of working out, because Michael's fantastic with computers, trying to work out how to do this thing. And we went over to, I think, Budapest and recorded the score. And it was a really interesting experience. We ended up going to the mix, which was in a studio in Times Square in New York. And it was a fantastic...
It was extraordinary.
...baptism of fire,
but it was
really,
off the back of that score that we got The Little Vampire. Which was also another baptism of fire, because children's music is very different to drama, period drama. A lot of notes. yeah. And so Nigel and I would be working, I don't know how many hours, probably 22 hours a day or something. I think we took it in rotas, because I was good at nights back then. And Nigel's good in the mornings. And so we just...
I think we should sort of clarify that Michael and I think it's very honest that we are a writing duo. Because I think today there's so many orchestrators and arrangers and teams of music staff, often behind some of the bigger names in films. Michael and I felt that what we always wanted to do was, I suppose, control things more by... literally knowing each other's thoughts all the way along, doing the orchestrations ourselves, doing the programming ourselves. And we felt that was a really honest approach. And Michael has a completely different body clock to myself. I'm very good at getting up very, very early in the morning
at
3 and 4. In fact, I think you got an email from me, Tim, this morning about 3.
I know.
And Michael... can go on to about 2 or 3 in the morning, where I'm sort of useless after about 8 o'clock in the evening. So between us, you know, we can work really very, very long hours.
That's a good thing, because as you know, that is what film music and scoring is all about, isn't it? It literally is, well, a race to the finish line for the last few weeks.
It's pretty intense, yeah.
So whenever you say you're working close in, well, I suppose in tandem with each other as such, clearly now with your latest score, which is so gorgeous, called Will, I can see already, you know, it's orchestrated by you, Nigel, and then a lot of the programming is by you, Michael, and the finished result
and written together
really quite a tremendous work.
Thank you very much.
We like you.
Yeah, it was lots of fun doing it. It was we both were immediately struck by the film because it's such a beautiful film, and our first reactions was that there weren't any weak moments for us. We both thought the acting was stunning, and especially from Perry Eggleton, the little boy who plays Will. We thought gave such a moving performance, and of course when you have really fantastic performances in a great film, it makes the score so much easier, because not almost anything you do works, but a lot more that you do works so much better for the film. And so I think the moment you start with a good film, it's much easier to write a good score.
I think the other fascinating thing about this film, we had a wonderful director called Ellen Perry, and actually she was the co-writer of the script, and she had very definite views of what type of score she wanted, and that was very, very helpful. You know, she certainly wanted something very classical, that really told the story by, I suppose, floating over the top of the film. And there's also some music that she put in the film that she declared right from the beginning that she wanted to be there, which wouldn't be our job to write, though I have to say we recorded it. And one was a wonderful piece of music by Hector Berlioz called Lelio, which is a sort of music theatre piece, and both Michael and I had never heard of it before. In fact, most classical orchestral musicians, which is really our background, had never heard this before, and that was really fantastic for us to discover some other music during this project.
There's such a rich tapestry, though, because you've got like a duduk, you've got a soprano solo, there's a cymbalom as well, and you were chatting there about, you know, certainly being experienced using ethnic instruments, but here you've mixed these with one of the finest orchestras in the world, no doubt, with the LSO. Incredible.
It makes for a fantastic sound canvas to work with. There's a section of the film that's set in is it Serbia or Croatia? Bosnia. Neither.
The Balkans.
I'll go for the Balkans. Yeah,
Bosnia.
Gold star, Michael.
Yeah, and that gave us the opportunity to use all these fantastic instruments. And the duduk has been used now for quite a few years. I remember hearing the duduk back in the late 80s, early 90s, on a CD by Jivan Gasparian, who's the great, you know, Armenian duduk player. And then it was used, I think, for the first time in a film, on a Robert De Niro film. What was it called? Can't remember what it's called now.
I remember Jerry Goldsmith used it prominently in the Russia House. Remember Sean Connery?
Oh, well, that would have been even further back, yes. So, anyway, it's the most fantastically emotional and wonderful instrument. And so an opportunity to use that was really, really wonderful. And obviously the cymbalom which isn't strictly Balkan instrument, it's more Hungarian really, but the sound world is similar. To put that over the top of the LSO was absolutely amazing.
I mean, what was very important, I think, for us with that we just didn't go down the easier road of just using samples and plonking those on top of a sort of orchestral backcloth. You know, Michael in particular spent a long time with the cymbalum player and the duduk player, really bringing them into the mood of the film, showing them the scenes that we had. And I think that's what we were very proud of, that sort of integration between their improvised, quite often improvised work, though Michael had often prepared guidelines melodically with what they should be doing. I think actually Michael and the players took many hours to get to what we felt was the right answer, and certainly I feel or remember Ellen, the director, being, you know, most pleased with the effect that brought to the film.
Well, let's have a listen to the opening cue on the CD and in the film, I believe. It's Anfield.
Although something that Nigel and I always tend to do with films is that we never write the opening cue first. It's a bit like writing the overture to an opera after you've written the opera, because obviously you need the DNA, the main tunes of the theme, the film to be represented in the opening piece of music. So we tend to write the whole score and then go back to the beginning and try and integrate all our themes together in the opening cue.
But straight away there, after listening to that, you know, that gorgeous sort of yearning immediately by, you know, the French horn solo, and that sort of yearning literally it continues throughout the full score, because I mean the story itself inherent is just so tender. I mean, it's just of course it's so sad, and for anyone losing their parents immediately there, I mean, you know, you get a lump in your throat just thinking about it, don't you?
The opening, you're absolutely right in what you say. The opening was particularly difficult in a really nice and challenging way. That for those that haven't seen the film, and hopefully will go and see the film, the opening title sequence is set in Anfield football ground, Liverpool's football ground, and it's these old, incredible black and white film clips of literally thousands of people in the Kop. In that particular stadium, swaying backwards and forwards, one body movement would almost make the whole crowd move. And so it's in the past; they're all wearing caps and collar and ties, as people used to in the old days when they went to football matches. So what we're trying to do is sort of evoke, I suppose, a tenderness and a nostalgia from the past, which sets the mood for Will's love of Liverpool football team. And by the way, that wonderful horn solo is played by the magnificent David Pyatt, horn player.
Yeah, he's actually a friend of mine, and it's just, I knew it was him. Whenever I heard it, I thought, that's definitely David. Isn't it cool? I mean, it's just incredible playing.
It's beautiful, it's beautiful.
Nigel will tell you, I'm not a particularly, or at least I wasn't a particularly big football fan. And yet,
no, me neither.
and yet, Liverpool Football Club, for me, is sort of transcends football. Really, it's not just about football. It's about a sense of family, a sense of community. Absolutely,
community.
And there's a lot of emotional. Stories going on with Liverpool Football Club, and I just feel that if I were a football fan, I think Liverpool would definitely be the team that I would support.
Well, yeah, speaking of which, the famous theme tune is "You'll Never Walk Alone." adapted from, of course, the classic Rodgers Hammerstein, but. There's a fantastic new arrangement here you've done. I mean, it's actually the closing cue on the CD. I know there's an interpolation of "You'll Never Walk Alone" further or in the middle of the score, and that's quite an emotional punch, that finale.
Nigel.
I was just enjoying people talking about it, actually. The strange thing about that particular cue, that was written away from the film. I think it's the only time that Michael and I can actually remember working completely blind from the film. For several reasons, you can't obviously cut notes out to make it shorter or longer to fit with a particular sequence. It has to be at a certain tempo. You can't really speed it up or slow it down too much. So I think in the same way that John Williams did the E.T. going off on the bicycle into the sky sequence, wrote that separately, and then the film was cut around it. This is what happened in this case, that it was written as a separate entity to the film. In fact, I think it was even with a view of not particularly using it in the film, it might have been just on the end credits. And then it seemed to emerge as being integral to the finale of the film. But we also felt it would be quite fun to do a huge, probably one of the biggest versions ever of that song. Hopefully it doesn't sound too much like a musical now. It sounds more symphonic and certainly is equal to Liverpool football team in the gravitas that it brings.
During those first, now I would urge everyone listening to check out the trailer on YouTube. It's such a lovely trailer because, thankfully, which is rare these days, your music's actually used in the trailer, which I guess you know about. And it does show quite a few great scenes. And Damian Lewis, doesn't give the full end away, but you can see that obviously his sort of ghostly presence is on the pitch there, and coupled with that music, just looks pretty powerful.
I'm constantly stunned by Damien Lewis's acting. I think he's such an amazing actor. Ever since I watched Keen, actually, he made a film. I don't know how widely known it is. A film called Keen with absolutely no music in it at all, actually, and it's just Damien Lewis wandering around the streets looking for his daughter. And I think it's over an hour. And it's one of the most stunning performances I've seen of any actor ever. He gives a very, very strong performance in Will as well.
I think we have to go back on saying that we had a very musical director in this particular case who really, you know, loved music. She was very passionate about music. And, you know, film music is a collaboration, and that must never be forgotten. You know, Michael always refers to it, music as being the third actor in a film. It's the actor that you can't see. And certainly Ellen was very upfront in what she wanted the music to do for her film. And we found that quite fun, because quite often today, I'm not sure if you're allowed to say this, but quite a few directors feel quite awkward with music, especially when it becomes to music that's a little bit more classical, because it might be a language that they're not so familiar with. But this was not the case with Ellen Perry.
Yeah, I think often directors feel intimidated by music, because they know what they like, and they don't know how to express what it is that they like when they don't have a piece of music in front of them. I find it very, very difficult to say what they actually want. And Ellen managed to do that and express exactly what she wanted while giving us the freedom to do what we do. And I think that makes for a very, very intuitive, very good director. And there aren't, dare I say, many of them around.
I think, you know, often the composers, or certainly Michael and I, feel that we almost have to be detectives trying to detect what is in the back of the director's mind, even though they might not know. And, you know, Michael and I were both classically trained at the Royal Academy of Music, and it's so easy to blind anyone with words of musical science, as it were. And it's trying to find a language that you can communicate with a director where, you know, you're literally on an equal level trying to discover what's best for the film.
Mm. Often temp tracks are often very, very useful, but they can also be extremely dangerous. Because directors sometimes fall in love with their own temp tracks, and they love them so much that they don't want to part with them at all.
So they're asking you to sound like someone else. And
exactly.
I think it's worse than that, Michael, that, you know, we've discussed this many times, that often the temp track is the London Symphony Orchestra, one of the marvellous orchestras from Hollywood, where, you know, colossal amounts of money have been spent on producing a high production quality. That is what is put onto the film, which you see as the temp. And of course, you're coming along, even though you can do it quite well, you know, the composer can do it quite well by using all their synthetic toys to make something sound magnificent. It's still not going to sound like a $200,000 film score, because it's not meant to. And I think that's one of the first big problems of a composer working, especially with a director perhaps for the first time, is to say what you're hearing now is only a small percentage of what you're going to get at the end when it's recorded by an orchestra.
Well, they need the imagination to see what the end product is going to be like.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, of course, these days, demos are so pretty good.
They're pretty
days,
good, but
demo.
Gone are the days where you could just play a tune on the piano and say, this is what it's going to be like. Because I think that's what
Tim,
Paul Williams
can we
did
ask
on
you
Jaws,
a question?
By all means, Nigel, go ahead.
Michael and I, you spend a lot of time with someone when you're writing a score. You know, it's literally 6 weeks living in each other's pockets, or 8 weeks. I mean, and so we're talking all the time, you know, and we're discussing, you know, the way music is now and where's it going. What's your view on film music now compared to, say, 25 years ago? Film music.
Oh, well, I mean, there's a can of worms.
That's why I'm asking.
Well, the thing is, I think it's so rare that music has a chance to breathe. That's the thing. You know, 25 years ago, And I know he gets a lot of stick for it, even today. I mean, actually yesterday, there was, I think, an article by Terry Gilliam saying, you know, John Williams has been given too much freedom. His music is telling people how to feel, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, 25 years ago, John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith, James Horner, you know, some of the greats were at least driving a film along, and their music was allowed to, well, you know, be prominent. Whereas these days, thankfully, I think Will's an exception, and I know other films have been an exception. How to Train Your Dragon last year with John Powell, that was a tremendous score. I don't know whether you both heard that.
Yes.
And I know Christopher Gordon in Australia, now he's a fantastic talent who unfortunately doesn't seem to get the right sort of movies. There are some great guys out there, but I think it's just there's too many people in the mix, isn't there? Literally in the final mix, saying, I think they're afraid of music, to be honest, aren't they?
Yeah. Especially. I purposely asked you that question in case you asked us that question. Because we daren't say it if we want to work again. I think the great thing that Ellen Perry did for us, she felt we were right sometimes when we would say, this scene is acted so well, it doesn't need music. And I think that gives the film far more space. We did a film score that didn't get in the way of the film. Now, obviously, I'm not going to mention names of other film scores, but I find it very difficult as someone that's involved in music, and I know Michael as well in this, that we go along to a large 2.5-hour film epic where there's literally not 3 seconds of musical silence in that film.
And it becomes
plaster on the side of a wall.
It's often not the composer's fault either.
No, absolutely.
I understand what you mean there. Yeah, I mean, when I say music is not allowed to breathe, I mean proper sort of structured music. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about like wall-to-wall sort of noise. Yeah. No, I agree.
And often the music will be very, very good, but if you put it on all the time, it'll just turn into dirge.
Big time, yeah. But that's why so many scores sound the same, though, isn't it? I mean...
Well, I think you're absolutely right on that. That's another discussion point that Michael and I are, you know, continually talking about, that I think 25, 30 years ago, a lot of films had significant identity thrust on them in a good way by the composers, where today, you know, you can roughly tell what school some composers come from, but it's almost the same generic sound that transposes from one film, juxtaposes rather, from one film to another. And Michael and I have really sort of prided ourselves really that we've always tried to bring our own identity to a film with the view that that's surely why we're being employed, is to have a bit of us in that film, not just to be some wallpaper that's put together and spread across that film.
No, well, thankfully for Will, that's certainly not the case. And Nigel Clark and Michael Chania Will's music drives the pretty heartbroken 12-year-old Will journeying across Europe to honour his father's wishes to witness the victory of their beloved soccer team, Liverpool, in the Champions League final. And we are going to hear a montage of some more highlights from the score. But just before we close, Nigel and Michael, maybe you could let us know your personal highlight on the CD, which is released, it's out now on Verez. Which, you know, out of all the cues, which do you think will be good to close on?
Oh, gosh, that's difficult.
That's a difficult one.
Michael first.
Well, I mean, I personally love Alex Past. Because I, for a long time now, have just absolutely adored the voice of Ilona Domnich. And I think she sings just as beautifully on this as she has done on everything else I've ever heard her sing. It was such a fantastic opportunity to work with her. I think that's definitely my favourite track.
Fantastic. What about you, Nigel?
This is very typical. I work very closely with Michael. I'd have chosen the same track. I think we're often of the same mind. I would have gone with that, really. I think it's a very difficult thing to ask, because, you know, not only is it perhaps the music you enjoy or not enjoy so much, it's different cues and different recording moments or personalities involved bring sort of emotional good baggage to it. So it's not necessarily always about the best piece of music. It's about a nice experience. And I'm going to add one thing. Michael was playing the piano on this score, you know, what's one of the joys of working with Michael? He's such a rounded musician, and in the Hector Berlioz cue that we recorded with the LSO, it involves two pianos, and Michael, with all the other stresses of recording in Abbey Road Studios and, you know, preparing the music and etc., Michael still had to play the piano in that, and I think that was quite fun, wasn't it, Michael?
It was nerve-wracking, actually, but it was fun as well.
It was fun for me, though, listening.
it was actually an honour to sit next to John Alley, who is the most extraordinary orchestral pianist around. I have so much respect for him, and to be able to sit next to him and play was really, really wonderful for me. So I very much enjoyed that.